Okay,
well, let's see what the family anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they
stayed
in the exact same spot both times. They're outdoors, I can say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please.
All right,
Lisa, are you ready for this?
My cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello, and welcome to edition 451 of Strange Days Indeed. Of course, the big news since the last program was the press conference held in Washington, D.C. at the Washington Press Club. And this edition will cover pretty much all of that, plus other things, with Dave Verlott, Stuart Miller, Richard Hall, and one of the organizers of that press conference, Leslie Kane of the Coalition for Freedom of Information. It's an action-packed program, ufologically speaking, and let's kick it off with Dave Verlott.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Verlott.
There are several threads on the UFO updates list that are inexorably intertwined. One of the threads concerns the Larry King live show that aired back on November the 9th, 2007. The further thread about Magaha or Magoo, and finally a thread about the press conference held at the National Press Club in Washington on November the 12th, 2007. The Larry King Show aired and provided some interesting reports, footage, and declarations by people who have had close, personal contact with UFOs. In one instance, a man who states that he physically touched one while it was on the ground, and in another, a man that was a skeptic who, after having his own experience, has done a 180-degree turn and freely admits that there are UFOs in our skies. The Larry King live show was basically the appetizer to the main course of the press conference. However, with that being said, in order for the show to be balanced, a skeptic had to be included in the panel discussion, and so was born the thread of Magaha or Magoo. It is very interesting to read the transcript of the Larry King live show, and in doing so, you get the benefit of not listening or seeing the passion with which the words are delivered. Now, whenever I encounter a skeptic, I don't automatically conclude that he or she is a debunker, because some skeptics are very open-minded. And if they get proof of any nature one way or another, they will freely admit they are leaning towards the most relevant proof they have heard, seen, or examined. I wish I could say that about Major James Magaha, USAF, retired, but unfortunately I cannot. He began by answering a very legitimate question about the validity of the people who spoke before him and inquiring as to whether or not he might be open to adjusting his thinking by saying, no, not at all, because what they are all talking about is basically anecdotal stories, and all of these things are basically easily explainable. And he just continued his nosedive from there. He basically told gentlemen that were there in the Rendlesham Forest that what they saw was nothing more than the light from a lighthouse. He also plainly said that Sergeant Jim Peniston, USAF retired, was lying about the whole thing because the Peniston stated that the tower was not manned that night. And Magaha says it was manned that night. And he states he interviewed the people who were manning it. Magaha goes on when asked if he was calling Peniston a liar about touching the craft by saying, "Oh, and this one is rich." "No, I'm saying he may truly believe he touched a craft." Oh, God. But Magaha doesn't stop there. When questioned about the JAL cargo plane incident in Alaska where a huge craft had been traveling in their airspace, he calmly explains that they were watching nothing more than the planet Jupiter because it was exceptionally bright that night. I, for one, am really impressed, but a little concerned that radar tracking stations are so powerful they can pick up planets in our solar system when they are misidentified as something flying in our airspace. I would really hate for an air traffic controller to give the order for a passenger aircraft to do some kind of radical maneuver in order to avoid the planet Jupiter, or the usual planetary suspect often mistaken for some UFO, Venus. As an aside, I've been watching the skies at night and during the day for a long, long time now. I enjoy the nighttime sky, and I've been impressed by how bright and large the moon gets sometimes. And I've been impressed by the planet Venus and other stars and planets that I've been able to watch. I'm not a pilot or specially trained in being observant, but I have never, ever seen an exceptionally bright planet or satellite of our planet like the moon and gone, "Oh my God, that's an unidentified flying object." Not once have I ever mistakenly identified a planet or a star for being what it was not. Now, I could be wrong, but I have to suggest that most people, when seeing something they have seen before, like the moon, exhibiting characteristics they have not seen before, like being exceptionally large in the sky, or exceptionally bright, or being visible during daylight hours, etc., suddenly lose their intelligence and immediately leap to the conclusion that it must be some kind of spacecraft or aircraft. The most interesting thing to come out of all of these linked threads is the fact that the U.S. government has admitted to doing discreet inquiries into UFO cases. And now that knowledge has been leaked to the public domain. It does beg the next question, though. Why bother to investigate something that officially does not exist? However, I must also admit enjoying watching Mr. Magaha trying to dance around being asked politely if he believed that some people were lying about what they experienced and digging himself further and further into a hole. Have the guts to put up or shut up, Magaha. If the man says he touched, not saw, not heard, but touched a craft underground, there can only be one of two possibilities. The man is lying through his teeth, or he actually touched a craft that is either from this world or from some other. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
And a damn good take it was, again, Dave Furlott. Magehe, Magaha, Magoo, we call him all kinds of variations during the course of this program. Misinterpretations, I think, was his favorite word. Everything was, they misinterpreted it.
All they saw was lights. I love when it says, well, no. We know what that light was. We know the lighthouse. It doesn't come in and go away and fly off and move. No, sorry.
I love James Fox saying, well, you weren't there, so how would you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
I don't know where they found Magaha, Magehe, Magoo, but he's a very strange duck.
Oh, he's definitely a different one. And don't forget as well, we have to give him credit, he is an amateur astronomer.
Oh, yeah, that counts for a lot.
Yeah.
It's somewhat like that astrobiologist Morrison out of California who answers questions to an astrobiologist answering a question about UFOs. And,
yep.
and Morrison comes off like a lot of skeptics saying, well, there have never been any astronomers who've seen a UFO.
Exactly.
Well, what about Clyde Tombaugh? I mean, just to name someone who probably absolutely nobody knows about other than him predicting the four-time hit on Jupiter and them actually getting footage of that happening.
Mm-hmm.
A famed astronomer who saw a UFO, let alone all the amateur astronomers who've seen UFOs.
That's true, too. Wasn't it McGaha who also got scared by a flock of geese at one time?
That I don't know.
I remember there was one amateur astronomer, or actually a debunker, and he was saying that he was watching this flight of geese and the stuff reflecting off of them, and he was looking at them, and he swore they were UFOs until they started coming towards him, and he really thought they were UFOs, and then he realized that he just misidentified a flock of geese.
Ah,
and,
another misinterpretation.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure, I'm almost positive that was McGaha. I could be wrong, but I'm almost positive it was him. I remember a very famous comment was, well, if I could be fooled like that, obviously anybody can. It's like, excuse me?
It's like the woman who works with SETI. She and her husband being freaked out by the moon appearing from behind clouds. And this is an astronomer who couldn't recognize the moon coming out from behind the clouds.
Oh, my.
Mm.
You know, I look up, I see the moon all the time. I've seen it in some very radical things. And I've seen it, like, ultra bright. And I've never seen it that bright before or that big before or ever again. But I didn't sort of look up and go, oh, my, UFO.
No.
I just went up and went, wow, that's a really cool moon. There's so much good information that came out of all of this stuff as well. It boggles my mind.
Thank you again, Dave Verlott.
Thank you.
And make sure and listen to what's coming up on this program. There's some really interesting stuff.
For sure.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Misinterpreting. They're just misinterpreting what they saw that night. Misinterpreting. They're just misinterpreting what they saw.
They're
that
just
night.
Misinterpreting what they saw.
They're just misinterpreting what they saw.
Misinterpreting what they saw.
They're just misinterpreting what they saw.
Misinterpreting.
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 Every few weeks we travel across the pond to Cheshire in the United Kingdom. Our British correspondent Stuart Miller hails from there. Hello, Stuart.
Hello, Errol. Hello, everybody.
How are things from your point of view as far as what's going on in the field of ufology?
Well, we're sitting here watching overwhelmed. In terms of similar events happening here, there is not a sign or a speck. But I must say, it's been absolutely fascinating for about the last 4 weeks or so, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot remember, I'm sure there has been, but in recent memory, I cannot remember such an avalanche of interest, of things happening in this field, and it's probably all going to collapse in a massive, you know, like a deflated balloon in a few hours' time, possibly. But obviously it's been very exciting, but it's also been very interesting as well.
Well, if James Magoo, the successor to Phil Klass, or perhaps even Michael Shermer, has his way with everything that we talk about, it's all misinterpretation.
Yes. I have seen the man before. I have seen the Larry King show, but it all fell into place, your attitude towards him on the list a week or two prior.
Yeah.
You were most rude to him.
I was indeed, yes.
And most justified. The one aspect of the Larry King show that's really perplexed me are the mysterious people that appear to have appeared on the show. I'm talking about, I hate to say this, but the misidentification of a number of guests. For example, I've read at least two people, possibly three, who thought that McGahey or McGaha was James Oberg.
Oh, really?
Yep. And I noticed just today on the list in an email from Eleanor White, that she made reference to Buzz Aldrin.
Yeah, and I wasn't sure whether she was talking about Buzz Aldrin being on the Larry King show a few weeks ago or referring to Magoo's most recent appearance on television, which was on the Larry King show this past week.
Yes. Vis-a-vis the confusion with James Oberg, surely he should be the rightful inheritor of Klass's former position. And really, if you're going to have a skeptical balance on a show, he would have made a much more articulate and a much more sensible inclusion than McGaha. My reaction to him was the same as everybody else's. I thought he was an absolute mess, a complete disaster. The only thing missing, really, were food stains off the front of his jacket. I mean, he looks a sort that would just, you know, he just looks a complete disheveled mess. And he really was. The one thing he taught me was how to call somebody a liar without actually using the word liar.
Yeah. Oh, no, they misinterpreted what they saw.
Yeah, they're confused, they're stupid, they're idiots. It really was a bizarre performance. He won't have won many friends with that.
No. No, and he was calling people like Colonel Charles Holt of the United States Air Force, who was second in command at Rendlesham Bentwaters in the UK, when Holt and several other people, including Sergeant Peniston, went out and checked out what Peniston insists was a 12-foot disc that landed outside the Air Force base. And Peniston put his hands on it.
He said something else as well, which I wasn't aware of about that, and nobody else seems to have picked up on it. And maybe it's a well-known fact, allegedly, or maybe everybody else has missed it, but he said he photographed it. There was something that Holt said when Holt claimed that he'd never been debriefed on the incident. I find that very, very difficult to believe, frankly. And somebody said, oh, well, if he'd been debriefed by the American Air Force, he wouldn't have put the report into the Ministry of Defense that he did 2 weeks later. There would have been no need for it, or something to that effect. It is difficult to believe, given the furore that the event caused, that somebody didn't sit down with Holt at some point and go through it with him.
Yeah, that seems rather strange, doesn't it?
It does.
The other interesting bone of contention between Magoo and the Rendlesham folk, Holt and Peniston, was whether or not the air traffic tower was occupied or not.
Well, you'd think they'd know. If you look at the show from, I suppose, a neutral's point of view, sitting there listening to all this flying backwards and forwards, I suppose Magoo might just have confused the issue sufficiently. But certainly, I think most people's sympathies, if they were a neutral, would have fallen the other way. He's not very good on television.
No, he's not. No, and not a good representative. And one wonders why, since they had used him previously, Shermer wasn't there, unless it was decided that because McGahey, and I'm using quotations around the word here, investigated the Rendlesham case, whether it was decided that Magoo McGahey McGaha would represent the skeptical point of view. Now, whether that was a decision that was taken by the skeptics or it was the CNN people that decided that they would go with Magoo, I don't know.
I don't think the skeptics are a cabal who make those decisions amongst themselves. I'm sure it was the TV company that decided to approach him.
Mm-hmm.
There's one other thing that he mentioned, actually, which I think he shot himself in the foot with when he mentioned the lighthouse lights. Even the most hardened skeptics, intelligent skeptics, people that have actually seriously investigated the case, have dismissed that as a possible solution to Rendlesham. Because I don't know if you remember, he was warbling on about the lighthouse.
Yeah.
So no starter.
Yes. And for the listener who'd like to read more, may I suggest that you use your subscription access information to go to the UFO updates list and go read what's been going on the past few days. There's a transcript of the television program Larry King Live online there, and also links to online video recordings of that particular program in case you missed it.
This may be premature, but I have to say that so far with his two appearances on the Larry King Show, I've been very impressed by the film director, James Fox.
James Fox, yes, me too. I've had him on the program in the past, and very bright, very articulate, a middle-of-the-road kind of film producer who has come down heavily on the side of UFOs exist. It's kind of hard to ignore the evidence that he has accumulated for both versions of his documentary Out of the Blue.
I was about to say, Errol, does anybody actually deny that UFOs exist? Obviously, they do exist, and I think really the issue is what they are. But there's no question that UFOs exist. Now, you can argue about percentages, etc., etc., etc. But even if you concede that there are 100% of sightings, that perhaps it's 5%, and that's just an arbitrary figure I've pulled out of the air, are unexplained, therefore it follows UFOs exist. And in the Kucinich sense, and the Jimmy Carter sense, it's an unidentified flying object, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
It would be an idiot, frankly, that denied their existence. But I understand what you mean with Fox. And, yeah, the guy is very credible. And at this point, it would appear that he can only do good. I could cast your eye down the list of
speakers.
Yeah.
At the press conference, which is actually happening as you and I record this,
yeah.
I have looked at that list, yes.
Any names jump out at you negatively?
No, not really. That was why I was particularly impressed with the potential for that press conference being held at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C.
Mm.
And any names leapt out at you that you thought, uh-oh?
No. The only thing I would say really is he doesn't seem overly strong on the American side. High up, you've got one Brit there, at least one Frenchman, Peruvian gentleman, an Iranian gentleman, and so on. But in terms of, I guess, at the higher echelons of American intelligence, unless I'm looking at a name and I'm missing the significance of it, there doesn't appear to be actually any representation at that level. Now, you could argue that's a good thing or a bad thing. It would be a good thing because presumably somebody speaking from that level would carry considerable weight and conviction. On the other hand, somebody from that background, quite frankly, could just be a plant. So it will be interesting to see what impact this has.
Mm. It's really a shame they didn't manage to get it put out live on the web.
Yes, it would be nice perhaps to have watched it, but really the significance of this would be in the impact it does or doesn't have afterwards.
Mm. Is Callahan, the former federal aviation guy who was on the Larry King Show last week, is he not on the...
Yes, he is.
Yeah, well, that's a fairly solid case, and Callahan makes that case very well. I guess if there are also former military people there, that pretty much does it for the United States.
Callahan's story, though, on the Larry King Show was extremely interesting because Fred went along. It got to the climax, which was a meeting at the White House where they reviewed all the information with a number of other people. And then at the end of it, the guy from the CIA said, get out. We're keeping this. Got nothing to do with the rest of you. That was the end of it. In the end, what can Mr. Callahan say? There was an unknown object, something that we weren't able to classify, to define. It appeared that he didn't use the word intelligent or intelligently controlled, but it appeared arguably to be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that really, in the end, is the sum of it.
Yeah, but he kept copies of all the reports, too, didn't he? That was an important point. So it just didn't disappear into the dark void that is CIA or Black Ops.
Well, very true, very true. But my feeling is that there is not a shortage of radar traces.
Mm-hmm.
I think they are available. Anyway, I wish them all the best.
Me too.
The one thing so far that doesn't appear to be the case is that it doesn't appear as flaky as the previous effort with
Greer.
Yeah. But talking of flakiness...
Yes?
Well, almost unnoticed, deservedly so, because it was a pile of rubbish, we had another release from Albuquerque on the alleged briefing document to President Reagan on UFOs was posted by our dear friend Victor Martinez to, I suppose, the equivalent of flat champagne. Even the believers didn't believe it. It really did sink. And hopefully that will be the message to Mr. Doty to cease and desist with this rubbish, because it's driving us all bonkers.
Is SERPO indeed rooted in Rick Doty?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I hate to say it, but that was a success. To start with, there were actually people that sort of half believed it. There were certainly a lot of people that wanted to believe it. And he got an awful lot of mileage out of it, an awful lot of mileage. There's no question it was a success. Even though, to anybody with an ounce of common sense, the moment you read the first couple of paragraphs of the very first email from Anonymous, it was obvious it was rubbish. It just seemed to catch people's imagination that maybe he just got lucky with the way it was written and timing and so on and so forth. You were lucky to avoid it, Errol, as you seem to have done, but it really did catch on many parts of the internet. It really did. There's no question that was a success. This has just plummeted like a brick.
Supposedly, SERPO documents are about a team from planet Earth who ended up on an alien planet.
On planet SERPO, yes.
On planet SERPO.
And this came about, Errol, as a result of the Holloman Air Force Base Exchange visit.
You
know all about that, yes.
Yes, yes, yes. And Linda Moulton Howe, and again, Rick Doty.
Yes. I have to say that Rick did a marvelous job of making SERPO sound like the most dullest place you could ever not wish to visit. I really was unbelievably dreary and uninspiring and unexciting as a planet. If there is intelligent alien life out there, I hope that it's much more exciting than SERPO.
It's kind of like the picture of Rick Doty from the British documentary that is in the process of being finished.
Yeah.
And you and I have both seen that picture of Rick Doty, and boy, he looks like somebody from SERPO, doesn't he?
That's very cruel. That's very cruel, Errol.
Well, and so we can put up with all of the nonsense that goes on. Like Magoo, Doty doesn't need to be made rude of?
I've never met him, but he does, as I think is known, he does turn up at one or two UFO conferences on an annual basis. And I think he puts his face in just to keep his ear to the ground, so to speak, to listen to what people are talking about and so on and so forth. And he doesn't disguise himself. He is known. He does seem to carry a certain presence, you know.
Well, it's like Phil Klass, except that Doty supposedly worked for U.S. intelligence.
Quite sure he still does, actually. The documentary filmmakers that you mentioned, I have talked to one of those gentlemen at some length, and the essence of the documentary, Mirage Men, they doorstepped Rick Doty, and they followed him around for something like about 3 months, and it was extremely interesting. And the guy is a mini-god, and is treated like a mini-god. He just wanders onto air bases, drags people along with him that don't have clearance and so on and so forth, and nobody says a word because it's Rick Doty. It's like that.
Really?
He's
known at all these bases.
Well, he's certainly known in Albuquerque. But anyway, enough of President Reagan's alleged briefing document. Another thing that came up, which I found very interesting to look at, and I think it was an article that you actually carried on the list, Plan 9 from Outer Space. I think it was an Australian gentleman who claimed to have got hold of some CIA documents on UFOs and posted them up in an article that got syndicated, I think, quite a bit. There's nothing new, or not a lot that's new in the article that he wrote, actually, that hasn't been covered by Nick Redfern and I think possibly Bruce McAbee even before. But it was very interesting to just be reminded of it all. Do you recall hearing the CIA department called ONE, O-N-E?
No. But then there's a lot of things that I haven't heard about.
Well, I'd not heard of them before either, and perhaps that is a weakness in my reading, but it's about the closest to reality that the concept of MJ-12 came. The CIA did form a department called ONE, O-N-E, to deal with UFOs, and it did consist of a cross-section of people from military and scientific background. But just the whole CIA approach to UFOs, you can have no doubt at all that they really took the subject unbelievably seriously and over a period of time. I mean, we know this. It's just nice to be reminded of it, I guess. For some very considerable time, they were concerned with the subject.
No doubt about that.
But it would appear, moving on, that the subject of the Clintons, UFOs, and the Democratic nomination just will not go away, historically. And UFOs have crept into the American election campaign again. And I must say, I was actually quite concerned before the King show about Shirley MacLaine. And she,
as many people were, yes.
Well, yeah, but my flakometer didn't move when she was on. I was sort of almost cowering behind the settee, worrying what she was going to say next. But you could pick holes, a great deal of holes in what she was saying. But she didn't sound like a lunatic.
No, not at all. And I think her years of experience now doing her own podcast have slicked her up considerably in her delivery.
Yes.
A lot of practice in getting that information out. Obviously, it was pre-recorded because they didn't move all the guests out of the studio to let her sit down and be interviewed and then shuffle everybody back, unless it was tidied up considerably. And I didn't see any evidence of editing during the course of her segment. And she was very clear, very precise, and just laid it out and didn't embarrass me at all.
I quite agree. But she did embarrass Dennis Kucinich. And I've seen the clip in that national debate where he was asked the question about his sighting, and he did actually look a bit uncomfortable,
mm-hmm.
and there was tittering from the audience. But I felt that he seemed a bit defensive, but I felt that he dealt with it reasonably well. He could have dealt with it better.
As Carter did in the clip that they ran on the Larry King show. There was some discussion about whether Jimmy Carter had backpedaled on his sighting on the UFO updates list last week. But it seemed to me that he wasn't backpedaling at all. He saw a UFO, and that's what he called it, an unidentified flying object. He didn't know what it was, and as we all know, it wasn't Venus or swamp gas.
Yes, I agree. He was very, I wouldn't say cold, but very objective about the way he described his sighting on the Larry King show. I think back in the 70s, he might have been a little soft around the edges whenever he did talk about it. I'm not saying he mentioned or used the word extraterrestrial, but I don't think he was as straight down the line. It was a good description. It wouldn't have done him any harm. And really, it's all grist for the mill in terms of what I regard as positive publicity for the UFO subject.
Yes.
The whole thing is, really, it's just the way it's all building up. And now, of course, we've had the release of Clinton's exchange of letters with Rockefeller that is about to be released. Now, that could be very interesting because, as we know, Rockefeller was absolutely absorbed with UFOs and really pestered the Clintons about it.
Yeah, until he got stiffed by Greer.
Yes. But it's like a PR bandwagon has been building up over the last 3-4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And arguably, the event that's happening now is the climax, or maybe there's something more to come.
Well, fingers, eyes, ears, nose, and toes crossed. And then I can have a life.
I don't think you've made that remark before, Errol.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, but I don't think you're going to get a life. I really don't. I don't think you're going to be able to rest. So that's not quite true. You will and you won't. You will know before your time comes. You will know the reality of extraterrestrial life. You will know that it exists. But you won't have the answer, or you probably won't have the answer to UFOs.
And as I have also said in the past, if I did get the answer, I probably wouldn't like it.
you may know as early as next year, actually.
Really?
You might do, yes.
Mm.
Yes. All being well, fingers crossed, you're in with a very strong chance of knowing next year.
Oh. Well, that's an exciting prediction.
It's not a prediction. It's not a fact because it hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I am making reference to the, and this won't excite you, but the Mars Phoenix Lander mission, which is on its way to Mars at this moment. It will get there, in all being well, next May. And if it lands in the right spot, and it digs in the right spot, we have a chance of knowing what everybody believes already to be the case, but still needs to be proved, that there is at the very least microbacterial life on Mars. Now, you know, that's not the same as a flying saucer landing and something with a head, two arms and two legs climbing out. But it's the first step.
Yes.
It is the first step.
What happened to all the discussion about the bushes and the tubes and the various other aspects of potential life having existed on Mars in the past? And we're not just talking microbes here. Whatever happened to all of that discussion? Are those websites still around, to your knowledge?
I don't know if the websites are still around, but if they are, you're not making very much noise. It's pretty hard to sustain those arguments. There were things that appeared to be anomalies to start with, and I think on further investigation, I'm not saying that they were disproved, but it just didn't seem to be a line of thinking or reasoning that sustained itself. It just seemed to fall away.
Or did it fall away because of the Mars face?
That's a good point, because that didn't help. Look, we know what we look like, but if we look at ourselves from another angle, in a mirror, if we find ourselves in a store and there's three mirrors around us, and we catch another angle of yourself and you look a bit different, which really is the gist of the argument about satellite imagery of the Mars face. The only way an issue like that is going to be resolved, truly resolved, is in 30 years' time when man sets foot on the planet. Or the original photographs of the face on Mars are, in my opinion, just as legitimate as the recent ESA photographs, which showed the whole thing at a different angle. And when you saw it from another angle, it looked like a natural phenomena. And until you get up there, we ain't going to prove it one way or the other.
Well, let's see what May 2008 brings us.
Yes, it's certainly something I'm looking forward to. The institution, SETI, comes under a great deal of attack from ufologists, and not just from ufologists, but from the science side and actually from the general population as well. And the crux of the argument often is, why bother? What a waste of money. Well, firstly, it's not publicly funded, so the money issue is a personal thing. But it certainly is an institution that attracts probably more criticism than praise. And on Thursday of last week, Seth Shostak wrote a marvelous defense of SETI, I thought, that covered all the points. You know, the first thing he dealt with was the finance, because I think a lot of people still do believe it is publicly funded, which it isn't. And the other issue he dealt with was why. Okay, you've got a philanthropist in the shape of Paul Allen. He's throwing millions of dollars at SETI. Why doesn't he throw those millions of dollars at world famine or dozens of other different needy causes? And I felt that Seth dealt with that point well. Basically, man has always spent money on other things that don't appear to be imperative to the well-being of mankind. And if he hadn't, then we wouldn't be where we are today. And I say that from the positive point of view, in terms of the advancements that man has made over the centuries. In the end, you can't dictate to an individual how he spends his money. He makes that choice for himself. I'm sure Paul Allen donates millions of dollars to what would be perceived to be more humanitarian causes, as well. I'm sure he does. But the point is, I thought it was probably one of the strongest bits of writing that Seth Shostak has turned out for a long, long time. I think he did a good job with it. I've said this in my blog. I think it's about time that we just stopped this rubbish with SETI and just woke up to the fact that really they're after the same thing that we are. We
might as well essentially, yes. Except that for us, it's a lot closer to home.
Yes, and in many ways, the two disciplines are not compatible, certainly from the SETI point of view, because, of course, if SETI concede the possibility of UFOs being extraterrestrial craft, then there's not really much point in pointing the big dishes up into the sky.
Yeah.
It's easier for us to sort of say, well, yeah, you know, go ahead and keep looking, because when you find them, then we can say we were right. It's one-way traffic, really, I think, from SETI's point of view. But as far as I'm concerned, we're on the same track, and I wish them the best.
I've always hoped they'd find something. I just, like a lot of people, have had a great deal of difficulty in wondering why they're spending all that money looking out there when nobody is looking at what's going on down here.
Well, I'm reminded when you say that of what I was going on earlier about that article on the CIA and UFOs, because they clearly were well out of public sight for something like about 20 years, very secretly and very quietly. I'm not talking about Project Blue Book or any of the other public faces of ufology in the States, but in the background, they were really seriously interested. In truth, it is wrong of us to say that science has never been interested, because it certainly has via the CIA. It's just never been publicly interested. But you can rest assured that the best scientific brains in the country at one time or another have looked at this problem. It's just that we don't know what their conclusions have been.
Yeah, and perhaps the U.S. Air Force consulted with the CIA when they decided that they would close down Project Blue Book, saying that UFOs present no threat to national security.
Yeah, the point was mentioned on the Larry King Show, and it's a point that is well known to anybody with an interest in ufology. We all know that no national air force, and it's the same here in the UK, likes to admit that there are things floating around in their airspace that they can't control, they know nothing about, and can't identify, and they can't stop them and check them and question them. So given that fact is a reality, though, that there are such things that do that, then the let out is to say that they don't pose a threat. As to whether they do or they don't is arguable. There will be people that will say that pilots have lost their lives chasing them. A Condyne report intimated that UFOs could be a hazard to commercial flights, but they're not attacking us. And so the American Air Force, and the UK Air Force for that matter, have got away with saying, well, they're of no defense significance. What goes on behind the scenes, of course, is entirely something else. I don't think, by the way, that the CIA and the Air Force, the American Air Force, were on particularly good terms in relation to this subject back then. I'm sure the Air Force were absolutely delighted to be rid of it. It caused them no end of trouble at all. And, of course, the CIA could just carry on quite in the background. But coming back to your point, I think it's fairly obvious that people have investigated UFOs from down here. We just haven't been told what they've found. It's a much more complicated subject than just the possibility of it being an extraterrestrial craft, because, you know, we need to remember the originations of this, the Cold War, the psychological effect. It's fairly obvious from reading this document that of equal concern to the American government was potential use of this as a psychological warfare tool by the Soviets. And so that weighed very heavily with the CIA as well. But they certainly took it seriously from the point of view of them being craft and whatever. We just don't know what they concluded. But my guess is they concluded, we haven't got a clue.
And, of course, they are doing damage as far as the abductees are concerned.
Yes.
But better to sacrifice a few thousand abductees than come out and acknowledge there is something going on in the skies over various countries that those various countries have no control over and can do nothing about.
Well, indeed. You know, in the end, we all need the obvious. We need a public landing of some craft, and then really all bets are off, and it all unfolds from there. Until that happens, yeah. We're blowing in the wind, I'm afraid. It's easy to deny. It's easy for the subject to be, well, less ridiculed than it used to be, certainly, but not to be taken absolutely seriously in terms of it being a true reality, because there is no hard and fast proof that is acceptable at a broad level.
We'll see what transpires over the next few years. And so here endeth the lesson from our British correspondent, Stuart Miller. A good one again, Stuart. A soupçon of anticipation as far as what's happening while you and I are talking right now, and we shall see what transpires.
Indeed. It could be a very interesting few weeks.
It could well be. Thank you, Stuart Miller.
A pleasure.
We shall talk to you again in a couple of 3 weeks.
Okay.
Okay. Bye, Stuart. Legend in the serious study of UFO phenomena and a well-respected researcher among his peers. He's a former assistant director and acting director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP, and consultant to the University of Colorado UFO Project, sponsored by the U.S. Air Force Office of Scientific Research. He's a former editor of the MUFON Journal and is past chairman of the UFO Research Coalition. And Richard Hall has his own website, hallrichard.com. published many, many papers and several books, the most recent of which, I guess, and the most important is the UFO Evidence Volume 2, a 30-year report. You will find links to that book and to Richard's bio and to his website on the program's listings page. Richard Hall, welcome back to Strange Days Indeed.
Glad to be here.
One of the reasons that I wanted to have you back on the program again is what happened in Washington, D.C. in the last few days at the Washington Press Club.
Yeah.
A major press conference there, and one that you actually attended as opposed to sniffing at.
Yes, I was there in the audience, and it was quite an affair.
Quite an affair, organized by James Fox and Leslie Kane. James Fox of Out of the Blue and investigative journalist and organizer of the Campaign for Freedom of Information as far as UFOs is concerned.
Yes, the Coalition for Freedom of Information is one of the driving forces in all this, and Leslie Kane is an investigative reporter primarily for them.
You went to this press conference, so you were anticipating something that was going to be useful.
Yes, I was privately informed about it, and they took steps to keep the lunatics out, and so they did not publicize it widely in advance until it was practically ready to be put on. So they were very wise to do that, and their tactics worked. It was pretty free of, there were one or two people in the audience that I recognized, but they were kept under control, so they didn't create any problem.
Oh, good, because I know there were a couple of organizations who were, once it was announced, were anxiously champing at the bit to try and inveigle their way into what was going on.
Yes.
And perhaps take credit for some of what was going on and apply it to whatever their agendas
are. Indeed, there were people with their own axes to grind and their own twists on things, but they had no effect whatsoever here. The conference was exceedingly well organized. It went off like clockwork. It was a very impressive affair.
On paper, it looked pretty damn good. And Stephen Kaiser out of Washington, D.C., posted to the UFO updates list in the last little while a compilation of everything that was said by the participants there, which is actually really useful. Probably not a lot of new information as far as a lot of our listeners and yourself.
Oh, yes. There was a lot of new information.
Oh, there was.
And incidentally, those were the formal written statements. They were not transcripts of what was actually said, but of course, they're pretty close. Except additional details were reported here and there. Then there were lots of private conversations and closed-door sessions and so forth. So a lot transpired. One of the most impressive witnesses was Major General retired Wilfred de Brouwer of the Belgian Air Force. He retired as a Major General. At the time of the incident in Belgium in 1989, he was a wing commander, rank of colonel, and he oversaw the pursuit by the F-16 jets chasing objects around, and he gave a detailed account of what was seen not only by them on radar, by police witnesses on the ground, and so forth. The bottom line is that they were dealing with a huge delta-shaped craft, which he had beautiful illustrations of, animated even, that put out powerful light beams to the ground, and these light beams on each of the corners or the axes of the triangle were each operated independently. They rotated around. And at one point, they withdrew partway up into the craft when the craft started moving, which indicates that something we've heard before, the so-called solid light cases where the beams truncate right at the end. So there's something very strange about that.
That's much in the same form as the Travis Walton case where he was lifted up by a beam.
There have been lots of reports of these beams, like tractor beams, I guess, is the popular term for it, where they just lift up and have a truncated end on it. They don't continue down to the ground at times. Now, another one that was a familiar case, but it's still very impressive to hear it right from the primary witness, was General retired Parviz Jafari, the Iranian Air Force
case where he was the second of the two F-4 Phantom jet pilots that was scrambled to investigate a big thing that was being seen by citizens all over the place. The first jet experienced electromagnetic effects and turned back to base, and he came in and encountered this thing, and it seemed threatening, and he tried to arm a missile to fire it, and his weapons panel went out, and all his communications went out at that point. And again, there were a lot of new little details of exactly what happened. It wouldn't be time to go into them here and now, but believe me, it was very impressive to hear it firsthand. And then another extremely impressive case that I was not familiar with at all, maybe others were, there was a Peruvian fighter pilot in 1980, it was a busy year, 1980, that encountered a brilliant, large, glowing object over the military base. He was a lieutenant at the time, Lieutenant Oscar Santa Maria, and he's retired as a commander. I don't know the ranks in Peru, but anyway, he only spoke Spanish, and it required a translator to get it. But basically, he encountered the thing. It was appeared to be invading their territory. He started firing at it with machine gun bullets, and the object just seemed to absorb the bullets. They didn't have any effect whatsoever. And at this point, he became frightened, because he didn't know what he was dealing with, and he was also running low on fuel, so he whipped around and headed back to base. And he was so low on fuel that he had to coast part of the way in his jet, and he just barely made it back to base. He admitted he was totally frightened by the thing. So these are highly impressive cases, especially when you see the people and hear them recount it face-to-face, and besides, they have a lot of documentary evidence of a lot of these things. This case and the Iranian case were both investigated by American intelligence agencies, and there's documentation of them, you know, in the loop. So
discreet inquiries, I think, was the way it was described, probably on CNN I heard it originally, with Larry King Live, of course, and then Anderson Cooper the evening of that conference.
I couldn't help but think I'd like to see Mr. Magoo, as we're calling him, Magehe. I'd like to see him sit down face-to-face with these guys and try to ridicule them or discount their reports. This is where witnesses like this can be so important to change public opinion. Now, I could also comment on what I think about the news coverage, if you'd like.
Oh, yes. Let's have your opinion.
As I said on the UFO updates posting I put, it was a mile wide and a foot deep. There was very widespread coverage, as we know, all over the world. And what they said was accurate about this group calling for the U.S. government to reinstitute an investigation in full cooperation with in other countries, a truly international information-sharing basis, and they got that right, but so far I've only seen one very sketchy account of an actual case, and that was by the CNN guy.
Gary Tuchman,
You know, the details of these cases are very impressive, and this is what they were trying to convey. We're not just blowing a lot of smoke here. These are serious matters going on, and yet this didn't get reported to the public, the details of the cases.
I've been trying to sit and figure that out over the last couple of days, why there was no coverage of the cases. Have you got a grip on that at all?
Well, I think it's primarily because of the nature of news reporting, the soundbite mentality. Apparently, I think they don't think the public is very smart. That's the implication to me of the way they cover the news these days. They must assume an extremely short attention span.
That of a gnat, yes.
Which might be true, actually, to some people, but there are lots of intelligent people out there who are yearning for, you know, good, solid, detailed information. One of the French representatives present I was sitting next to, and at one point at a separate meeting, it wasn't during the press conference, he said the next day that they had front-page coverage in newspapers in France. Now, I'd like to see. I know there was an agency, France Press, guy present, but his story was not terribly in-depth either, but they might have reported more to their home newspapers.
Might make a good documentary for either Paul Kimball or David Cherniak, who's still grinding it out.
It's already going to be a documentary by James Fox.
Ah!
He's already working on a sequel to Out of the Blue, And there was some filming that went on at this, so it's already in the works, that part of it. We'll get out eventually, but it just seemed to me a shame that they hung the whole story on the call for an investigation, because people have been calling for an investigation for a long time. But the important news here was that these were very high-ranking, impressive people that had personal experiences and personal encounters, and not a peep of that got out to the public, really, only in a very generalized terms.
Fox and Kane seem to have slanted it toward these objects being a menace to commercial airliners.
Yeah, well, that was partly deliberate on their part to point out that what's going on has national security interests implications, and that you can't ignore it, because when things come flying into your airspace that you can't identify, that's serious. Oh, incidentally, the more than one of these people told stories about that. The Belgian general told us privately that there was a case which he described, and I can't get into details about it, but it went up to his superiors. He was a colonel at the time. They decided, well, it isn't attacking Belgium, therefore forget it, and essentially threw the report out. That goes on. I mean, this is the way the military tends to think. They're not a scientific investigative agency. They're defending their countries. You can understand, in a sense, unless there are other scientists that they can pass it off to, that that's where it's going to end.
It's that quote that I keep attributing to Cordy Bryan, CDD Bryan, who said on one of the news programs, I think it was, again, it was Larry King, he said, well, if I were the Secretary of the Air Force and these things were flying in and out of my airspace, I'd deny that there was anything going on, especially when I couldn't do anything about them.
Right, exactly. But if some of these cases had been briefed to scientists, for example, and at the time, they could have had more effect. But you can understand the way the military approaches things.
Well, you know, handing things off to science in the past has not proved very fruitful, has it? I'm thinking
of
the condom.
Well, that's because the scientists are not very aware of cases like this.
Yeah, but I was thinking more the Condon report that seems to have put the brakes on any sort of scientific investigation over the last 30 years.
Yeah, it's had a very negative influence.
Did anybody else impress you there?
Oh, yes. There were several presenters from countries. There was one fellow that from Chile who was tasked by his government. He's a captain and pilot in the army there, tasked with investigating the subject for his government, and he did, and found a lot of substance to it and gave a report back about that, and he told us about his findings and so forth. And also there was our own FAA guy, John Callahan, who was excellent, talking about he reported directly to the FAA administrator, who at the time was Admiral Engen. And Admiral Engen said, the FAA doesn't control UFOs, it controls airplanes. Give it to somebody else. So there's passing the buck going on, and it was passed on to the CIA, and the CIA immediately squelched it and even told them, you shouldn't talk about this, it didn't happen. And so there you have some of the different agency mentalities on display.
And again, one has to wonder why those mentalities exist among those agencies.
Well, you can see why, because the FAA guy, he put it right. They're not responsible for UFOs, so he doesn't want any part of them.
Yeah.
That's where their area of responsibility ends, is exact parallel to the military. They're not invading, therefore we're not interested. So that's the way it goes, but there's no one with an overview. You would hope that all this information would be centralized in some agency or other, and especially one that wasn't totally secretive, that was open and public. That's one reason they suggested NASA in this press conference, but I don't think NASA has budgetary problems already. That'd have to be a totally new budget for them to take this on now.
Of course, there's still the outstanding results of the judgment in the case between CFI and NASA over the Keksberg incident.
Yes, there's that too. But if they were tasked to study UFOs and given the budget, they probably would do it.
I guess for any sort of body to study what it is that interests you and I would take a lot of money and a lot of finances.
Yes. Well, actually, this is one of the questions that ex-Governor Symington was asked, what sort of a group do you envision? And he said, I would think that a public-private, a government and private sector commission of highly respected people would be the best way to go about it, and that would ensure honesty by the government. You know, we do commissions all the time here, so that sounds good to me. I'd be happy with that.
Somebody like Joe Firmage or Robert Bigelow to put up some money?
Yeah, in fact, if it begins being taken seriously, there'd probably be lots of other people come out, too. I still vividly remember back in the 60s when the Condon Committee started into work, and boy, did the interested people come out of the woodwork there. There were all sudden all these major scientific agencies and scientists and household name people coming out of the woodwork that had been underground and had an intense interest, but there was no money, no support, especially public support, because the ridicule factor is still very strong. But if you get to a stage where it's respectable and they're looking for high-level people to study it, oh boy, I don't think you'd have any shortage of support.
And especially with the World Wide Web the way it is now. And
yeah, that's changed things altogether.
Donating money and a donation of $100 or $200 or a little more would give you access to a news list.
Yes. I think it's doable. It's just getting through all these barriers that is so difficult. But I think it was an extraordinary event and could have a very good effect if all goes well, and if there are reasonable follow-ups, and if the crazies stay out of it and don't try to exploit it for their own ends.
And unfortunately, there have been several crazies around, and we have talked about one or two of those on the last program or two, so the listener will know pretty much who we're referring to in this instance. I just had this feeling that all of this is just going to fade into the background again in view of everything else that people are going through in their lives and what the planet is going through politically and physically.
Well, as prominent people have said, is nothing like people from out there bringing us together.
It would certainly make all of the population on this planet us and those out there them, rather than the us and thems that we have down here at the moment. But then there are still the loonies out there who...
Oh, yes. Oh, there are many, many obstacles. And as you know, I've been at this for 40, 50 years, seeing the ups and downs and the problems and very promising seeming developments that fizzled out and ended up going nowhere. But nevertheless, even though the Colorado Project ended in disaster, it raised consciousness a lot. It was a step forward, maybe a baby step, but it was a step forward.
Yeah.
You can only hope, but, you know, I'm very realistic, like you. It may just fizzle out.
Oh, I so want it to all come together in our lifetimes anyway.
It's, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I have no great faith at my age that I'll live to see it all, but as I say, this was highly impressive and extremely well done.
It's good to know, because as people who read the UFO updates list and who have listened to this program on a regular basis know, there are a lot of things that really get under your skin about what's going on in the UFO field at the moment. So it's encouraging that you're encouraged.
Well, maybe I'm just dreaming, but I still think it could go somewhere. I think it is a step forward.
Any juicy UFO gossip you'd care to share with us?
No, I don't know.
Aww.
I was listening to Sirius Data. I don't listen to gossip.
Yeah, but it seems that the only real data that moves around in the background in this field is, perhaps I was being a little facetious calling it gossip, but I'm privy to just a very tiny number of buzzes that are going around, and I thought that you might be privy to a lot more than I, since your seniority.
Oh, I hear stuff that's going around, but I don't pay a whole lot of attention to it. I will tell you one thing that I found humorous. It turned out I was sitting one row ahead of the CNN reporter.
Gary Tuchman, yes.
Yeah, and when the question period came, Sullivan had said that he felt that the government didn't want to scare the public, and that's why they held it back. And Tuchman stood up and said, How can you say that? This government doesn't seem to mind scaring us at all. They scare us every day. That one won't go on the air, but it...
But at the same time, the wars and the killings are a lot closer to home for a lot of people than something that potentially could be coming from out there.
Oh, I know. He was joking in a way, and he was also asking a serious question, because unfortunately... news people seem to get hung up on this issue of why is the government keeping a secret? We don't know why. They may have the absolute hardware, a la Roswell. They may be frightened, confused, not knowing what to do with it. There are any number of speculative possibilities why they're practicing this secrecy, but the news media get hung up on that. They should pay more attention to witnesses like this. You would hope that Tuchman would go and interview and get more detail. They offered him all kinds of documentation, evidence, radar screen data, videotapes, and I don't know how many followed up. That will be forthcoming, and we'll see. There might be some specials forthcoming here that will make use of some of that information. I certainly hope so.
I hope so, too. That would be highly useful. And apparently, there is some sort of organization that, in fact, other than James Fox, that videoed the press conference. And
well, there were cameras all over the place.
This is one of those sort of semi-official organizations.
Yeah, well, there were several organizations, including, I think, the Funds UFO Research guy filming it, private agencies, and Jamie Foxx was filming it, and lots of other people, all kinds of news agencies. This was a huge ballroom, and it had balconies on either side.
Mm.
And I looked up, and there were cameras up on both balconies.
Good. I really trust that somebody in the media somewhere does a big story and that'll keep it going. A la O'Hare,
yeah.
When that broke back on January 1st.
Oh, I think with all the filming that was going on, somebody is almost certain to come out before Fox. I mean, he's going to have a definitive one because he had inside track. I'm sure some of the regular documentary people will be producing material here. I just hope they do a decent job of it, because I have no great faith in documentary filmmakers, except with your Canadian exceptions.
Yep, Paul Kimball's done a really fine job. I'm really looking forward to seeing David Cherniak's two-hour doc on the social implications of UFOs, because
uh-huh.
He has done some quite extraordinary work.
Yes, I met him. He pulled up in front of my house here with his gigantic motor van.
Yes, we covered his travels around the United States on this program last year. He's done the rough cut now and probably won't hit the History Channel until next fall. They're saving it, but apparently the History Channel is very happy with what they've seen in the rough cut.
Good. I hear from everybody that Out of the Blue was quite well done by Fox. I have not seen it. I must be one of the few ufologists who has not seen it, and I suspect that's because I don't have a DVD player. If it's on VHS, I'd like to acquire one now, having seen them in action, but I don't know if it's on VHS.
Listeners, Richard Hall needs a VHS copy. Go to his website, hallrichard.com. You can get in touch with him via that site and email and connect. And who knows, maybe you'll get a half a dozen offers, Dick.
Well, that would be great. But again, we have forthcoming, definitely we have his follow-up to Out of the Blue. What is the name being used for it? It's
Further Out of the Blue.
Or
Deeper in the Blue?
Oh, I forget now. There's some working title floating around.
Yes.
It still has the word blue in it, but it's a variation. But anyway, that will be forthcoming fairly soon. And so that's something to look forward to, and that's likely to have good influence, because
yeah,
the guy has used superb judgment from what I've seen here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
And his Out of the Blue documentary is wonderful. Is wonderful, and I know that you'll thoroughly enjoy it once you get a copy.
Okay.
Richard Hall, as always, thank you, sir. I look forward to talking with you again.
You're both welcome.
And perhaps maybe we'll even have some really good news the next time.
I hope so.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Well, all this talk about the press conference at the Washington Press Club this past week or so, I figured it would be kind of nice to talk to one of the organizers of that conference. Leslie Kane is an investigative journalist. She has worked in radio. She's a writer. She now is a mover and shaker with the Coalition for Freedom of Information. And she, along with James Fox, organized the conference that happened in Washington at the Press Club. And joining us on the line from her home in New York is Leslie Kane. Leslie, congratulations. It was just a superb event.
Well, thanks very much, Errol, and let's just hope that the momentum keeps going and we get some concrete results from this.
I trust that that will happen, too. I know that Richard Hall and Bruce McAbee and several others, including Don Berliner of the Fund for UFO Research, were in attendance. And Richard Hall, who is one of those UFO researchers who has been around forever, and I know that Dick Hall was extremely happy with the way things unfolded.
He was, and I'm so pleased about that because I probably admire Dick Hall just about more than anybody in the whole UFO research community, and he's been a great support and a great mentor for me. I consult with him all the time, and so what he has to say means a lot to me, and I was very pleased that he was able to attend and that he felt that it was a success. By the way, he's going to write a fairly lengthy piece for our website about the event and sort of consolidate what he thinks the key information is that was presented there so that there's something that we'll be able to hand out to people who just want to read a quick few pages of kind of overview. So I'm very happy he's going to do that.
And the link to that website that Leslie is talking about is in the program listing for this program, so you won't have any trouble getting to it as the listener. You played your cards pretty close to the chest on this one, Leslie, you and James Fox. It seemed to me that nobody heard about it until about a week before when it was announced that James and various other people were going to be on the Larry King Live show. Was there a specific reason for staying so quiet about it in advance of the event?
Yeah, there was. It was actually a decision we made early on, Errol, to do that. Just because, for one thing, we were so incredibly busy, we didn't want to be inundated with emails and requests from people about it. We also wanted to restrict the door at the event, so we were concerned that we'd be inundated with requests from people who wanted to attend, and we'd have all these long exchanges over email, and we just thought it best just to keep it quiet. This was really an event designed for the press. It was not an event designed for the UFO community, although, of course, we want to make it all available to them, and we're going to, but it just seemed like for us to just stay focused on what we were doing and not for things not to get out of hand, the best strategy was to be very quiet about it. And you're right, we only made this public, I guess, about a week before. And I don't regret that decision. I really think it was the right decision.
I think so, too, because what happened as a result of that press conference was that there were several groups who climbed all over it and behaved almost as if it was their own event and contributed greatly to their agendas.
That was another concern, you know, without mentioning any specifics. All the complexities that can come up when something of this magnitude is being planned, everybody wants to get their piece of the pie, and we just did not have the time to deal with all of that.
Mm-hmm.
The other reason was we did not want it to get out into the media before we had our – this is a key thing, actually, Errol. We wanted to be able to position this event with our own language and in the way that we wanted to do it for our own reasons. So we didn't want this to get out into the media before we were ready to release our own press advisory about it. So that when the information first came out, it was from us, not secondhand from somebody else. That's also an extremely important reason to keep something quiet.
And then probably, too, you would have had the people who were in front of the media, you might have had them hassled, too.
Absolutely. Another very important point. You're absolutely right. So there were many reasons, and that was another one I didn't even think of in the moment, but why we decided to keep it quiet. As I said, I have no regrets about that.
It was quite a lineup of people that you had there, both former military pilots and government people. Was it really difficult to get a hold of some of those people? I'm thinking of the Chilean and the Brazilian and the Belgian, De Brouwer.
Yeah, every individual had their own sort of history in terms of the relationship that we had with them and getting them here. We had three South American people, two from Peru and one from Chile. One of the problems there was that the language, I was the one dealing with the South American people, and every single email had to be translated. And we had to hire a translator, so there was always the language barriers that took place. And then you depend on people to respond by a certain time, and they don't, and you're dealing with a foreign language, and they don't respond to email, so then you call them, and there's a lot of logistical stuff in communications that took a tremendous amount of time.
Yeah.
We were so fortunate to have General De Brouwer, who you just mentioned, from Belgium, and the amazing thing there was that I wasn't able to locate him until quite late. We tried in the beginning, and he sort of got put on the back burner, and then it might have only been about a month before or something that I was able to find him by going to a contact in Italy who knew someone in Belgium who was a friend of De Brouwer's. And through that friend of my contact in Italy, I was able to find him. But, you know, this is the kind of thing you have to go through.
Yeah.
But once we actually got to these people, we had something that we sent them explaining the intentions and our approach and all of that. They were all extremely receptive and very happy with the way we were presenting the material and how we were positioning the whole issue of the UFO issue. So once we got them, everybody was very enthusiastic. And we had a number of other people who had accepted and then for various reasons could not attend. And a couple of other generals were in that category, so we were sad to lose them. But I think we ended up with a really amazing group of people.
Really, really.
These are among the best, most credible people in the world, as far as I'm concerned.
Not only did you have General De Brouwer from Belgium and the Chileans and a Peruvian, but you also left me scratching my chin going, that was a coup, was the Iranian pilot who had a lock-on onto a UFO and tried to use his weapons, and they went dead. That was an interesting find for you guys.
Really was, because as I'm sure you know, that Iranian case, which took place in 1976, is one of the better known and one of the best UFO cases on record. And it was also documented by the Defense Intelligence Agency in the United States and is described in detail in a DIA document that was released through the FOIA. So people are very familiar with the case, but to have the opportunity to spend, for me, I had spent 3 days with this Parviz Jafari in Washington, and to have him be able to come to this event was astounding to me. And it took a lot of work to get him here because it cost a lot of money to get him here too, because he had to go to other countries to get visas and go through a lot of rigmarole in order to actually be able to physically get himself here. We managed to pull that off. He has family that live in L.A., so that helped. There was a tremendous amount of work in getting these people here and getting them visas. And, you know, Errol, one of the most amazing moments for me at the whole event was the first night we arrived, which was Saturday. We all flew in 2 days before the press conference. And we had General Jafari, who had just arrived, all the way, you know, a 24-hour trip that he made to get here. And also Comandante Oscar Santa Maria, who was our other really outstanding panelist from Peru. And his case was sort of similar to Jafari's in that he was, in 1980, he was an Air Force pilot, and he was up there attempting to shoot down a UFO as well. It's an amazing story. Not as many people know about it as they do the Iranian case, but it was also documented by the U.S. government, by the way. But his story is just as remarkable as Jafari's. And we were sitting there at dinner with these two gentlemen who I was just meeting for the first time. Both of them were there, and they were to a group of maybe six or seven of us at a table, and they both told their stories in the same location they'd never met before.
Wow.
To this group and to each other. And to me, it was just such a profound thing to have been able to have these two men in the same room and meet for the first time with these extraordinary, very similar stories. So to me, a lot of the purpose of this event was to bring these people together for their own benefit so that they could interact with each other, share information, and begin to form a kind of an international coalition that we hope can continue to maintain contact and to pool resources over the years. But that was a moment, you know, really I will never forget. Then we had a Spanish translator there who was able to translate for, and it was just chilling. It was just profound to hear these two guys telling each other what had happened to them.
Amazing. Was there a language problem with them?
General Jafari speaks very good English.
Ah, good,
yes. He's our Iranian. He had to have translators on hand for the Spanish-speaking people, particularly the two Peruvians. They needed it. And that night at the restaurant, our translator hadn't arrived yet, so there was the guy sitting at another table who happened to speak fluent Spanish, and he got up and offered to translate for us.
Oh.
And so this guy just came and sat down and translated this remarkable story. I don't know what he thought about it. You know, right at our table, and that's how the whole thing happened.
and probably blew him away, too.
I don't really know what he just seemed quite matter-of-fact about it, and then left when it was over. I don't know how it affected him, but I don't know if he realized how historic that moment was.
Or maybe he did, and he was intelligence.
I hope not, I don't care. We're making all this stuff public anyway.
Yes. So. The press coverage of the conference itself was quite deep and broad. My disappointment has been that there were no cases, no stories of the cases that those people at the press conference represented. I don't think I've seen anything online that narrates any of those cases, even in the smallest possible way.
The press articles are also sort of short in little bits here and there, but they may have like a one-liner where they'll say, yeah, as you point out, you know, an Iranian pilot who blah, blah, blah. But they don't have a whole paragraph devoted to recapping any of the stories.
Yeah, which is very, very odd to me.
Well, I guess most of the press, like Reuters and AFP and these wire services, always write very, very short pieces. And so if they were to devote, you know, 3 or 4 lines to one case, they'd hardly have any space left for anything else. This is so unfortunate. I wish we could get some top-of-the-line journalist who could write a more in-depth piece about this. And you never know. It might happen. You know, the London Independent did one. I don't know if you've seen that one. And it was a little bit longer than the others, but it didn't do the kind of depth that you're talking about. If I were covering this, I would want to write about it. And I'm a journalist, and I can do some writing about it, but I don't work for big papers. I don't have access to the newspaper's major columns or anything like that.
It's like Dick Hall said, we live in a soundbite culture.
I agree with that. That's a major problem. And I think TV is even worse than print. I mean, I really was not pleased with the TV coverage on CNN, I have to say.
The subsequent or
the subsequent.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with the Monday night, you know, the day of airing they did on Anderson Cooper.
Oh, on 360. Oh, yeah, I sat and I watched it. I recorded it. I have it on DVD, preserved for posterior.
Yeah, for posterior, exactly.
Yes.
I mean, it is on the Internet. Anybody who wants to see it can. It's on YouTube and all these places. I just was not happy with that. And I was much happier with the print stories, particularly the Reuters piece. Reuters was the first bit to come out, the first news story to come out. It was within hours of our event, and it was a very good story. I liked the way they did it, even though it was, of course, too brief, but nonetheless, I think it had the right tone and it said the right things. So maybe Reuters sort of set a standard for print media that was somewhat different from the CNN bit. I much preferred the print coverage to the TV coverage, let's put it that way.
I don't understand the CNN compulsion to bring in the persecutory skeptic.
That's, oh, I know. They all want to do that.
What was your take on Magoohoo or...
Magoohoo? Magaga? Whatever his name is. Poor guy. It doesn't help him to have that kind of a name.
No. Or that kind of personality.
No. I mean, obviously, it does not come across as a very intelligent person. I don't think he has any charisma or intelligence. And it makes it much easier to demolish him, which I think James Fox did a very good job of doing.
A splendid job, yes.
Yep. So, you know, but it's just a little pathetic. I think Michael Shermer, who is a much brighter guy, I don't know why they didn't use him. I was not involved with the Larry King Live. That was James's work. He's worked with them for months to get that to happen. That was just his thing. It was not my thing. But I do know that the CNN, as I talked to one of the producers of the show, it's a matter of policy that they are required to have a skeptic on. So they, and not just for UFO stories, but for anything that's at all, I guess, controversial or whatever. She said that it's generally policy for every story they do.
A so-called balance.
Something. It's just so silly when you have somebody on who doesn't know anything about what they're talking about, though. we all agree. I mean, we're all on the same page on that one.
Absolutely.
It's just a waste of airspace.
Yes.
That's what they do.
Yes.
At least they didn't quote him in the print article.
Did anybody talk to him?
I guess not.
I guess not.
I remember when they covered Phoenix Lights, I think it was during the time that the Symington story broke last March.
Yes.
There were some stories there that had McGaha thrown in. I remember that. But that may be because he's made all these comments about the Phoenix Lights being F-16 jets and all this. But I'm so glad that they didn't do that with these stories.
And, of course, at Leslie's website are all of the statements that were made during the course of that press conference in Washington, D.C. And, again, you can get to Leslie's site via this program's listing.
And let me add to that, Errol, that not only are the statements there, but we have bios of each of the speakers on the website so that people can read the little bios first. And I think it's very important to realize when you're reading the statements who the people are that are presenting the statements. And if you just have a name, you're not going to know necessarily their background and their what they do. So I really like for people to be able to read it that way.
As a result of this press conference, you, the organizers, put out a declaration. Perhaps you could fill us in a little on that one.
Sure. What this is, it's an international declaration to the United States government. And Coalition for Freedom of Information is the facilitator of this document. This was really something we did independent of filmmaker James Fox. And it was crafted by myself, and a couple of the panelists had some input into it as well. And basically, it's a page and a half statement requesting that the U.S. government open a new investigation into UFOs. We're talking about reopening, but we don't want to make anyone think that we're talking about a repeat of Project Blue Book. So this is a very impressive statement because it was signed by, I think, about 9 countries. We have signatories on it, 12 of our 14 panelists, but we also have some additional signatories, people who couldn't make it to the event, such as General Alexei from Russia, General Letty from France, and a number of others, General Bermudez from Chile and General Chamorro from Peru. So we have 4 additional generals on this list. And it's just explaining what some of the problems are with the fact that the U.S. government does not investigate the UFOs on an official, publicly official level. And it's asking the government of the United States to join in cooperation with these other countries and to be part of an international dialogue about the subject of UFO investigations. Most of the signatories are from countries in which their own governments are actively involved. And some of them are even part of the programs, many of them are, who signed, involving the official investigation. So we're trying to show the U.S. government the contrast between the way they're behaving and the way these other countries are behaving. Not accusing them of anything, just inviting them to join this international effort. And we're going to be very aggressive about getting this document to the right people. I mean, I'm not going to let the momentum drop here. And my next challenge is, through some of the contacts that I have in high places, is to find out how to get this document to the appropriate people and how to hopefully do as much as we can to pressure the U.S. government to do this. So I'm very interested to see where that goes. And we do think it's a very important step, and all of these people around the world agree, that if the U.S. government is holding back, it creates a huge effect on the world's ability to deal with this problem for obvious reasons. And if we're ever going to have further steps, such as hearings or anything else that I know people want, it seems to us that the first step is to get the U.S. government engaged with this issue. And then from that point, maybe other things can happen. So this is our approach to the problem, and I hope people will go on the website and read the document. It's something I'm very pleased with, and personally for me, this is one of the most important aspects of this whole press conference, was to have a unified statement from people around the world at the highest levels making this request of the U.S. government. I just feel like that's a really important effect of this. And the whole effort is obviously not over yet. Our press conference was the jumping off point for hopefully something to actually happen.
I know that there are a lot of people right behind you folks waiting for something to happen now.
Let's hope. Can't guarantee it, of course.
No, of course not. The torpor that seems to have overtaken many governments over this is pretty remarkable. But when you consider all the things that they have to contend with, I guess this is probably number 872 on the list of things to do.
Exactly. Especially, you mean, in the United States.
Yes.
I'm sure you're absolutely right. It's not considered very important. But the event at O'Hare Airport that happened just a year ago, actually, which I think the timing is
this
really
month,
nice, was
really
certainly an illustration of the problem. We reflect back on that in this document, and a number of our panelists reflected on that incident as well, as an illustration for how a government should not handle an incident such as this, and for an illustration of the difference between other countries' responses and the U.S. government's response. If this event had happened in another country, it would have been handled very differently. In one of our other countries that was represented, let's say, it would have been handled very differently than it was here. That incident is a great window and a highlighter of what the problems are that we're dealing with.
When are we going to be able to get a recording, either audio or video-wise, of the press conference?
I'm glad you asked that because I'm inundated with emails making that request, which is wonderful. James Fox is the filmmaker. He filmed the event, and he's going to make a DVD available to anyone who wants it. But he just needs the time to get the footage into the studio and get the thing cut and get it copied and all that has to be done in order for people to be able to have it. So what people need to do is to keep checking his website. And I'll have a link to it from my website, but his website is outofthebluethemovie.com. He already has something up there that just says, we will be offering a DVD. People need to just keep checking back with that. And when it's available, it will be made very clear on that website. But it definitely will be. We want everyone to be able to view this. There's no intention on our parts to keep it secret or anything like that.
It would also be handy to add to the document that you want to pass up the pecking order.
To be able to include a copy.
Yes, yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
There are a lot of reasons we definitely need to have it, and we want everybody who wants to see it to be able to. So just keep checking back to that website.
And, of course, if you happen to avail yourself of your access to UFO updates, dear listener, then that will undoubtedly feature prominently when the announcement is made of the availability of the video. Also in Washington, D.C., Leslie Kane, was your landmark case against NASA, demanding that they release all they know about the Keksberg incident. And that's what we talked about, I think, the last time you were on, and those proceedings were still ongoing then, and there has been a resolution to that case against NASA.
Yeah, very, very much to my satisfaction, too, I have to say. The federal judge ruled in Washington on October 16th on a settlement agreement that my attorney put together with NASA. We can't use the word victory because it's a settlement, but it really was in our favor, the whole thing. And basically, it's requiring NASA over very specific periods of time to do an extensive search in very specific offices that we have asked for. And it's all spelled out in a settlement document, which, by the way, is on my website for anybody that wants to actually read it. It's about 7 pages. And they basically are going to have to do the search that they should have done for us in the first place, under court supervision and in a way that was, you know, as I said, deadlines for certain things to happen and lots of things that make it easier for me to get what I want. And they also have to pay legal fees on the case, which is certainly a suggestion of who's the victor here and who isn't. I have to take my hat off to our attorney, Lee Helfrich, who did the work on this, basically. And she's just been absolutely unbelievable, and she's an expert on the Freedom of Information Act and has put in hours and hours of unpaid for time for this to happen. And it is a landmark case because there's never been, as far as she knows, she said there's never been a case where this kind of success was achieved by the plaintiff without congressional intervention, where an agency is forced to do a kind of a search at this level, this kind of extensive search. Usually Congress has to intervene for that to happen. And she said it's just unprecedented for this to happen, let alone in a UFO case. So I'm extremely pleased with it. And the next few months, I will be working with NASA. I think it'll take probably 3 or 4 months before we've completed the whole process. It'll be very interesting to see what they come up with.
Indeed. I think it was Don Ecker, when I had him on the program a couple of months back, who suggested that the reason for the cover-up by NASA might well be
misinterpreting.
There had been a Russian satellite that came down in that area, and because of the agreement between the United States and Russia to return any technology that falls out of the sky, they had wanted to keep it under wraps because they wanted to examine the hardware and not admit to having a Soviet satellite land in Kecksburg.
Right, and I understand that. I'll address that in one second, but I also wanted to just say, too, when you mentioned a cover-up by NASA, I've never accused NASA of any kind of cover-up, and I do not necessarily believe there was any kind of overt cover-up. So I think it's more an issue of bureaucracy, of people just being lazy, of not doing their jobs and not willing to go ahead and do the search, or for whatever reasons they just don't fulfill their obligations under the law. They have not fulfilled their obligations, but I in no way want to make a statement that I'm accusing them of any kind of cover-up, just to make sure that that's clear. That came from your mouth, not mine.
It actually came from Don Ecker's mouth.
Don Ecker's mouth. Okay,
yeah,
well,
yeah. So we can blame him. He can take it.
You know, he can interpret it any way he wants, but I just want it for the record. It's not my interpretation of the whole business.
No, understood.
Okay, so in terms of the Russian satellite, it's a very interesting point, and the reason I don't ascribe to that theory is that I have worked with a man named Nicholas Johnson, who is the chief scientist of orbital debris. I forget his exact title, but I have an extensive piece about him on my website again. He is the number one expert in the world on space objects, orbital debris, satellites, and all this kind of stuff. And he heads up a whole agency, which is ironically a NASA agency. There was a Russian satellite that crashed in Canada on the same day as the Kecksburg event, and that's probably what Don is referring to. It was called Cosmos 96. It came down at 3:18 a.m. in Canada, and we have documents from the U.S. Space Command which informed us of this. This is all on the record. And then the Kecksburg incident happened at 5 p.m. on the same day. Still, a lot of people have said, well, maybe parts of the satellite were still orbiting, or maybe somehow this still was Cosmos 96 that came down in Kecksburg. And this Nicholas Johnson, who I mentioned, was able to obtain the orbital coordinates for Cosmos 96. And what he did was he plotted if Cosmos 96 parts had continued after 3:19 a.m. when it crashed in Canada, let's assume it didn't crash in Canada, or let's assume parts of it kept orbiting, he was able to plot where that thing would have been at the time of the Kecksburg incident, and it would have been nowhere near Pennsylvania. So this man was able to state on the record that there is no way that the object that landed in Kecksburg was a Russian satellite, because we are aware of all Russian satellites that were in the sky.
Of course, there were not secret
satellites. And he's aware in his database of any objects that come through the atmosphere. He said that when something comes through the atmosphere, it's always observed and recorded. And he has access to all the data that tell us what came into the atmosphere on that day. And he said it absolutely could not have been a Russian satellite. And he even made the statement that because of all the records he has access to, he can make the statement that there is no man-made object that could have fallen on Kecksburg, Pennsylvania at 5 p.m. on that day. Now, because he's the expert in the world on this, I'm taking his word for it.
Yeah, it's not.
Some people may want to think, oh, it's part of the cover-up. He's just not telling her, blah, blah, blah. But I don't happen to believe that. As far as I'm concerned, that possibility of it being Cosmos 96 has been eliminated. It's just not no longer an option as a possible explanation. I have an extensive piece I wrote for IUR about this, about the whole Kecksburg investigation that I've been involved with, but I have a whole section in there about this very question if anybody wants to read more about it.
The International UFO Reporter.
Right, and it's again on the freedomofinfo.org website. You can read that piece. So it's really one of the key arguments that people have made over the decades, which I personally believe is no longer a viable argument. And the thing that's so interesting about Kecksburg is we keep eliminating more and more of the possible explanations for what it could have been. We still, of course, have no idea what it was.
Yeah.
Possibly, maybe some very, very secret thing that we didn't return to the Soviets and we were supposed to have returned. Which is sort of along the lines of what Ecker was saying, not a satellite, but maybe it was something else that was highly secretive, I suppose a possibility, although Nicholas Johnson thought it was an extremely remote possibility, because he says he has access to even to data, even on experimental things and secret things. We don't know. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. NORAD tracks everything that moves through the skies over this planet and over the United States. And I would think that people would inform them of anything secret so that there wasn't a major hue and cry raised by NORAD when this secret, whatever it was spotted. So they would know in advance that these secret things were going to be going through their airspace or the airspace that they keep an eye on.
Right, and I guess that's the data that Johnson had access to, and you have to also ask, even if it was something like that, you have to ask the question whether all these years later, this happened in 1965, whether it's still necessary to conceal that.
Yeah, to keep it classified.
But, you know, especially when you're dealing with lawsuits and the kind of pressure that is being put on them now, you would really have to wonder if it's really something that has to still be kept secret. So anyway, I hope we learn something from our next step in this lawsuit.
Boy, you have a couple of major next steps coming up, don't you? In the lawsuit and out of the press conference.
Absolutely. Those are two things that I'm going to be devoting myself to over the next month. That's right.
Are you receiving funding for any of this work that you're doing?
Well, there was funding provided through James Fox for the Washington event, and it cost a fortune.
I bet.
But fortunately, he has contacts with some wonderful people, individuals, private individuals, who want to support his film, which, you know, a lot of the purpose of this for James was to be able to film it for this new movie he's making. So as part of that whole package, he had some donors and investors who provided funding for the event. A lot of them were just plain generous people who believed in what we were doing. That's another point that's so important, Errol, because to really make a change and to do really significant things, it always costs a lot of money.
Don't I know it?
Yeah. So much of what stands in the way for people that want to accomplish things. So I just feel so fortunate to have had these donors that made this possible.
Yes, yes.
As I've been fortunate to have the support over the years for CFI, not for me personally, but for the team that I was working with back in the beginning of the first few years of this Hexburg work.
Are the science fiction channels still involved with CFI?
They're still very supportive. I mean, I work closely still with Larry Landsman, who's an advisor to CFI. And the channel is entirely behind everything we're doing. I don't like to speak for them, but they no longer have the budget to actually provide funds for it.
Oh, too bad.
That's the bottom line, and that's because of reasons outside of their control at this point. But we never could have launched this effort if they had not had the budget for that. And they did, and it was just a tremendous, tremendous gift, because that's what it takes to do things. We had to pay a law firm. We had a private investigator working for us. We had a history research archival firm in Washington called History Associates that did a lot of digging around in terms of remote archives and things like this to help us access information. And we had a public relations firm also working on this with us.
Yeah, so Podesta Mattoon.
Podesta Mattoon, right. Yeah. They've now changed their name to the Podesta Group. And so all of that required quite a large budget. I maintained my independence by not going on the payroll. I wanted to maintain my independence as a journalist and not be working for the Sci-Fi Channel. So, but everybody else needed to be paid, and they were. And then once everybody got involved, they stayed with it. They stayed with it through today, regardless of funding or not funding. So,
which means that a lot of formerly disinterested people have become intensely interested in the intervening years.
Absolutely, mainly our attorney, who was very skeptical in the beginning about anything to do with UFOs, and this became her mission. She's been, tremendous. She's learned a lot. She's done a lot of her own research, and it's really amazing to see that happen.
Well, look what happened to Leslie Kane.
That's true.
And to me, and to everybody.
To all of us. We all had our moment, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
Where that little hook was launched. The little hook took bite.
Yes, it did.
And it's never let go since.
And pulled a lot of skin away.
That's true.
Leslie, I look forward to hearing the outcome on both of these projects that you're working on, and I'm sure that the listener does too. And on behalf of the listener, our thanks to you and to James Fox for all of the sterling work that you've been doing. And I say it to you every time, thank you for all your work, but it keeps mounting up. It's quite astounding how much you have accomplished since you first got involved in the field. My regards to all the people that you know that I know, to James Fox especially. I had interviewed James a little while back when Out of the Blue 2 was coming out. I had a colossal technological failure here. Had emailed James to let him know, but I guess he'd just gotten so damn busy doing his thing, we didn't get a chance to reconnect.
Once he gets going on this new movie, it might be interesting for you to speak with him then.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's going to be an Out of the Blue 3, which is really going to be not even an Out of the Blue 3, but a whole new piece with mm-hmm. his name and everything else, which will include a lot of the footage from the press conference and all the behind-the-scenes stuff. And that's going to be a major feature of the new movie, so it's going to be absolutely terrific. I have no doubt about it.
And it would be good to send copies of that to friendly reporters, writers. Billy Cox is just so on everybody's side here that it's...
He's been great. I really, really like him. We had a long talk the other day. He can't publish anything unless it's got a local hook in his newspaper in Florida. Sort of, but whenever he can, he always gets on it.
I know.
So you were talking about sending out the DVD of the press conference.
Right,
yeah,
right.
No, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. We'll have to get a whole new strategy up on that one. Yeah, you never know. Maybe we'll get some better writers involved, better journalists involved once that is available.
Again, thank you. My fingers, eyes, ears, nose, and toes crossed that the outcome on both of these things that you're working on will be just absolutely mind-bogglingly good.
Well, thank you, Errol. I very much appreciate what you're saying. I've enjoyed talking with you, and I'll keep you posted on everything that goes on.
Please, yes, we all have an extreme need to know.
You certainly do, and you'll be the first to know.
Thanks, Leslie.
Okay.
Until next time.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Everything you really needed to know about that conference in Washington, D.C., and the CNN coverage, and the lack of in-depth coverage by the world's media. We'll see what comes out of that press conference in the coming weeks and months. Thanks to Dave Perlot, Stuart Miller, Richard Hall, and Leslie Kane. And thanks to you for subscribing. And go read UFO updates and click on the links in this program's listing. You'll find fascinating reading. Look forward to next time. Bye.
That's this edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again.